Boy, oh boy. Short announcements, short hymn. If you have a short sermon, it'll be a perfect day for everyone, right? Well, I hope that you were able to get in the mail recently the newest publication from the church, our booklet on the United States, Britain, and the Commonwealth in prophecy. It's always a challenge to come up with a new name for a booklet that's kind of been around for quite a while in some form or another. It's been one of the booklets that has been utilized by the church and one of the most requested booklets of all time since, you know, the modern era of God's church has started. And so I'm glad that we finally have this in print. There's some additional new material in this booklet that has not appeared in any of the previous booklets. And I'm just very glad that it's out. It takes its rank alongside of a few other booklets historically that have been used very, very powerfully by the church. One of the early ones that was used to great success was the Seven Laws of Success. I don't know how many of you remember the booklet, The Seven Laws of Success. Yeah, some of you do, and a lot of you don't. But it was one of those booklets that just was right up at the top of church literature many years ago. And I was reminded of that booklet, The Seven Laws of Success, just this past week. I wanted to share why, and to discuss it a little bit with you here by way of introduction for the message today. In that booklet, Mr. Armstrong, the author of the booklet, The Seven Laws of Success, talks about many of the famous men that he had known through the course of his life. Yeah, I see you shaking your heads. You remember these stories. He was able to interview a good number of the most successful people of his day. And he did it as a research project, as well as just a personal project, but he was examining what were the causes for different people's success. And he identified seven different laws or rules that successful people utilized. And so that was the genesis for his book. But he gave descriptions of their lives, and all of them, and he knew many of them, all of them still had something lacking. He said that almost all of them utilized the first six of the seven laws of success, but they were missing the seventh, all-important seventh law of success. He said that some of them died in ignominy, some of them died paupers, even though they had achieved success. Others died suicides. So how can you say that these people were truly successful if they had that kind of emptiness in their lives? Quoting from the book, it says, "What was the real meaning of life to these successful men? Their goal in life, their definition of success, was material acquisition, recognition of status by society, and the passing enjoyment of the five senses. But the more they acquired, the more they wanted, and the less satisfied they became with what they had. When they got it, it was never enough. Some successful men of the world maneuver to get their pictures on page one of metropolitan newspapers or on the front covers of national magazines. This inflates and briefly titillates ego, but it never satisfies for long. There's nothing the public forgets so quickly as yesterday's news. Such men seek the flattery of others, and they engage in backslapping to invite it. But like an actor's applause," the word always makes me think of applesauce, "it doesn't last, and it leaves them flat with a gnawing inner hunger for something that will satisfy. So they become restless, discontented. Their bank accounts may be full, but their lives are empty. And what they do acquire, which is never enough and never satisfies, they leave behind when they die. What's wrong? Such men started out with the wrong goals. They had not discerned the true values, but they pursued the false. Isn't it about time we learn the true definition of success?" Some of you will remember these words from this booklet. He identified the seven laws of success as, number one, to fix the right goal. Number two, education or preparation. Number three, good health. Number four is drive. And, you know, if you think of successful people, aren't they driven? They drive themselves. They generally don't need to be driven, but they have that inner drive to succeed, to achieve. The fifth law of success is resourcefulness, because we always run into roadblocks along the way, and we have to figure out some way to work that out. Number six is perseverance, never giving up. And number seven, the all-important number seven, is contact with and the guidance and the continuous help of God. And that's the one that was missing in most of their lives. Now, if you have number seven, that kind of fixes number one, doesn't it? Having the right goal. That is the undergirding foundation of everything else when it comes to attaining true success, which was really the theme of the booklet. True success, not just material success. And we have that opportunity as Christians to know and to be able to attain to true, lasting success. Something that the world, despite all of the accomplishments of so many in the world, is lacking. Well, I was reminded of this booklet by a couple of stories I heard coming out of the recent Olympics about certain of these really remarkable athletes and the success that they have achieved in their athletic endeavors. It seems to me this Olympics just highlights the tremendous success and athletic prowess of certain individuals that are performers there. And I mentioned it in my weekly update, how there are teams and there are individuals whose physical performance in athletics almost seems superhuman. I mean, how do you go for five consecutive Olympics winning gold medals in all of them, like Michael Phelps has done? That's just a record that who's going to ever beat that? Who's going to have that longevity, much less at that level of performance? It's absolutely incredible. The women's gymnastics team, so strong, so deep, and so powerful a team, winning in the individuals, both gold and silver, as well as gold for the team competitions. And others, and I won't list them all, but it's remarkable. But out of the Olympics, I heard a couple of stories, and one of them in particular regarded Michael Phelps, the most decorated Olympic athlete in history. To date, he has one more race yet tonight, so he may well add to this. To date, he has accumulated 22 gold medals. He was disappointed to come in getting the silver in his race just last night. You know, he considered that a failure because he didn't get gold. If he had won gold in his race last night, it would have been the fourth time in the Olympics he'd won gold in that event. That's just an incredible record. But he won silver last night. He has a team event yet this evening that the U.S. team is widely anticipated to win gold for. The most decorated Olympic athlete in history. I'd like to read you an article that I came across the other day. This was actually a link that I had that I followed from Facebook, I think it was, but it brought me to an article from Church Leaders magazine about God using a book by Rick Warren, author Rick Warren, called The Purpose-Driven Life, to rescue Michael Phelps from suicide. After the Beijing Olympics 4 years ago, where he won, what was it, 8 gold medals or something like that? 5 or I forget how many it was. 8 gold medals in Beijing. He retired from the sport, and his life basically went downhill. This is what the article says. If there's one thing the Olympics can teach us, it's that hard work and perseverance can pay off. If there's one thing it can't teach us, though, it's how to measure your life. Surely, if you've won an Olympic medal, you would feel accomplished, right? Surely, if you've won as many as Michael Phelps, you could feasibly ride that feeling of accomplishment the whole rest of your life. However, this was not the case for Phelps. Even after winning 8 gold medals in Beijing, Phelps says he despised the image of perfection his success had created. He was about as perfect as you can get in the water. But that doesn't mean his life was perfect. It doesn't mean he was perfect. And he despised, he said, the image of perfection that that created. In an interview with SportsCenter, Phelps explains, "I was just a train wreck. I was just a time bomb waiting to go off. No self-esteem, no self-worth. The article asks the question, how does the most successful swimmer in history have a self-esteem problem? And maybe if you've watched him at the Olympics, it doesn't look like he has much of a self-esteem problem. Phelps had stumbled onto a truth that many Christians know. Our sense of worth and purpose was never meant to lie in our accomplishments or the praises of other people. Boy, when you're at the top of the game athletically, you get a lot of praise and acknowledgement from other people. But if that's all your life is about, there's still a gnawing emptiness. Because really, how long does that last? The end of the race? The end of the competition? You go back home? Your name comes up maybe in the next Olympics as the person who won last time, and maybe not. And before long, your name disappears from history. You were at the peak one moment, but you know, favor doesn't last. Well, the breaking point for Michael Phelps came in 2014. See, after the Beijing Olympics, he retired. He was burned out from swimming, tired of it, and he just wanted to kind of get away from swimming and all the people that were associated with swimming in his life. And he went and he followed the path, essentially, of what we would recognize as the prodigal son from Scriptures. He went out and he just lived it up. He said he had the money, he had the opportunity, he certainly knew the people to be able to go and do it. And he lived the party life. But it was not a happy party life. He was unhappy. And things came apart in 2014 when he was pulled over for a speeding ticket in his hometown of Baltimore and tested for alcohol and was twice the legal limit. So he got a DUI. It was his second DUI in 10 years. And after that, he spent the next 5 days holed up in his own home, just secluded. There's a video where he talks about it, and he says that he didn't eat, he didn't sleep. He was just, it was the bottom of his world. His life was terrible. He explained he even contemplated suicide. Most successful swimmer in history. After his most successful showing, he contemplated suicide. He said, for a moment I thought it was going to be the end of my life, literally. Yeah, it'll probably be better without me, is what he thought about the world and his people in his world. He said, people don't have to deal with the garbage that I give them or the trash that I put them through. I just figured the best thing to do was to end my life. Then enter Ray Lewis, a former Baltimore Ravens linebacker and a friend of Phelps. Lewis helped pull Phelps off the floor, so to speak, pulling him back into his own dark experiences. That's Baltimore Ravens linebacker Ray Lewis had his share of dark experiences, and he was able to kind of connect with Phelps in that respect. But Lewis helped Phelps to see that there was hope to turn around. Lewis and other friends convinced Phelps to seek help at The Meadows, which is a rehabilitation center actually just outside of Phoenix here. And Phelps went into the rehabilitation center for a period of about 45 days, and he said, I just surrendered, he said. Lewis also gave Phelps a copy of a book, The Purpose-Driven Life, written by Rick Warren. Phelps explained the book helped him by turning him into believing him or into believing that there is a power greater than himself and a purpose, he said, for me on this planet. Now, I'm not here to endorse Rick Warren's book. I haven't read the book. I've read excerpts from the book. And I'm not here to say that in Michael Phelps' conversion to God and Christianity is the model for what conversion to Christianity ought to be. But he came to recognize that there had to be something greater than himself that he had to somehow connect with to provide him with a purpose and meaning in life. Because up until that point, he had no purpose or meaning in life. And all the medals that he'd won and all the acclaim that he'd achieved didn't ultimately mean anything. It was more a burden then it was a blessing. And here's somebody at the pinnacle of success in his field was suicidal because he didn't have meaning until he came to this understanding that he had to have a contact with someone greater than himself. The book contained the message that Phelps needed to hear. I'm continuing in the article, that it's not about accomplishments and it's not about praise. Life is about God and our need for Him. Phelps's revelation sounds similar to Sean Johnson's, a gymnastics darling of the Beijing 2008 Olympics. After incredible success in Beijing, Johnson felt the same way. Not even an Olympic medal can mask the feeling of worthlessness that comes from not knowing God, that comes from not knowing our purpose in life. It's kind of a remarkable story. Now, you see Michael Phelps today, if you've been watching the Olympics, and he's not suicidal and he's not morose. His life has obviously changed and he has a different composure about himself than he had before. He's a more mature individual in that respect, and his life has changed. But what Michael Phelps learned was the very same thing that King Solomon had to learn a few thousand years ago. King Solomon wrote about it for us in Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Let's turn back to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Actually, you can almost pick a page in Ecclesiastes and find this lesson expounded. But we'll just pick this one in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, and we'll read in verse 17. Ecclesiastes 2, verse 17, "Therefore," Solomon said, "I hated life, because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me." Doesn't that sound like what Michael Phelps came to think? He came to hate life. The work that he had done was distressing to him. His whole swimming career was more burden than blessing. Solomon came to say the same thing. All of Solomon's achievements. Think about it. King of Israel. Fabulously wealthy. A scientist. A researcher. I mean, he had everything he wanted. And he said, no, his work that he did under the sun was distressing to me. He said, "For all is vanity and grasping for wind." Ultimately, these physical things, they're passing. They don't last. There's a temporary greatness or joy that comes from them, but ultimately it goes away. It's passing. It's vanity and grasping for wind. Drop down a few verses to verses 22 and 23. "For what has man for all of his labor, and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun?" Well, some can say, what I have is a gold medal, or two, or 22. And you've got a gold medal, and you can hang it up on your mantle, and you can frame it, you know, do all these things. Isn't that awesome? Okay. Now what? I mean, really, you get a lot of people to look at the gold medal and go, ooh, ah, okay, well, now what? "What has man for all of his labor and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun?" Verse 23, "For all his days are sorrowful and his work burdensome. Even in the night his heart takes no rest." What did Phelps say about those 5 days that he just holed up in his room after he was arrested and got his DUI? He didn't eat, he didn't sleep. His heart took no rest. Solomon says at the end of verse 23, all is vanity. You know, Phelps went through this after the Beijing Olympics. He retired, burned out, and he turned to mirth, which is what one of the things that Solomon tried to do too. Just, you know, finding satisfaction, joy by physical pleasures. He ran the same course. Go back a few verses to verse 1, Ecclesiastes 2 and verse 1. Solomon says here, "I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure." How do most people live their lives? What do they pursue? Don't people just pursue pleasure? Let's find the next thing to make me happy, and they pursue pleasure. Well, there's nothing wrong with things that make us happy. I'm not here to, you know, throw cold water on somebody saying, hey, let's just have a good time tonight. Let's go to a movie or let's shoot pool or whatever, you know, have a good time. That's fantastic. That's great. We should do that. But if that's all your life is about, you're going to find out you're really missing something. And there's still a big, huge hole there, because after all the pleasure, there's still a big hole there. And you just have to keep filling it with more pleasure. And people end up finding that they can't get enough of it, and they'll find it ultimately in things like drugs, chemical, or liquid, or other things that just pursue endless pleasure. Solomon said, come, I'll test you with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure. But surely, he said, this also was vanity. Verse 2, he said, I said of laughter, it's madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? After you've laughed, had a good time, you know, won your game or race, whatever it is, what have you accomplished? Verse 3, I searched in my heart to know how to gratify my flesh with wine. Apparently, that was one of the things that Michael Phelps tried to do, too. Got arrested 2 times the legal limit. I tried to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom and how to lay hold on folly until I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. You know, Michael Phelps only traveled the path that Solomon traveled thousands of years ago and that how many millions and millions of people since have followed. Phelps got his second DUI before he went in for treatment and realized ultimately that he needed a purpose, that he needed to find some meaning. He needed to find some meaning in his life. The search for meaning is everything. It is a human craving, a desire, and a need. We all have to have an appreciation of some meaning. Meaning for our life, meaning to someone or something else. And if we don't have that sense of meaning in our lives, there is a forever gnawing and growing hole in our lives. We need meaning. Ecclesiastes, the entire book is devoted to this one lesson, this one profound truth. Solomon sought all of his life for peace, for satisfaction, for happiness, for success, true success, and he had the means to pursue it all along the way. He tried everything, and he found out all of it was emptiness, except for one thing. What was his conclusion? Ecclesiastes chapter 12. Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and verses 13 and 14. He sums up his whole experience of pursuing success, pursuing happiness, pursuing stuff. Ecclesiastes 12, verse 13. Let's hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments. Have a relationship with God. Know Him. Live His ways. For this is man's all. This is where you find all summed up. This is it. It's what it's about. Verse 14. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil. You see, there is going to be coming a judgment. And there is going to be coming a reward. And the reward of our work in the Lord, our work in God, our work for God and for His purpose and for His people, to see His will accomplished. Our work in that will be rewarded. And guess what that reward is? Eternal. That's an eternal reward. An athlete can work and work and work for 4 years from one Olympics to the next, and he gets his reward, a medal, if he gets his reward, a medal, and then it's done. And then the favor and the acclaim and the praise and everything that comes along with that, it's over. And in a generation, nobody even remembers his name anymore. They might have to look it up in some dusty record book. They don't have record books. Now they have everything digitized. They might have to blow it up, you know, stop playing Pokemon Go long enough to say, yeah, is there a record somewhere back there? It's done. It's over. So you have all of this work that goes into an accomplishment that lasts how long? And then it's done. Our work in God's church, in God's way of life, our calling as Christians, has a reward that is eternal. It never fades or goes away. Now, there's some meaning. That gives some meaning to the work that we do as Christians, doesn't it? Our work. The meaning that is achieved by and through it is eternal and doesn't pass away. And it has great, enormous significance. Think about the significance of our work, or the work that God is doing in and through and with us. That's really the better way to put it, isn't it? Because it's not our work all alone. We're only joining Christ. We're only joining God in His work. He's invited us to that, to participate in that. Think about it. You know, most people, if they're swimmers and they get invited by Michael Phelps' coach to come be a part of the team, what an honor to be a part of Phelps' swimming team, you know? I want to be on that relay team for sure. That's incredible. And you work hard because that's an amazing team to be a part of. God has invited us to be a part of His work, His team. There isn't a better invitation to participate in anything than that. And His team is working to do what? His team is working to bring into His family virtually all of mankind. Of the increase of His government, there is no end. He's growing a family. And the work that we do is ultimately in the service of others whom God is working with, calling, bringing into His family, and granting eternal life. That's an eternal blessing, an eternal reward that is absolutely phenomenal. So when you think about it, the meaning of our life comes by virtue of our calling, doesn't it? That desire of God to say, I love you and I want you a part of my family, and the work that I'm doing that will never fade away, that will only grow. When Solomon said that this is man's all, because God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil, the good, the reward, is phenomenal. It's the only thing that will last, because everything else is temporary and ultimately selfish. And whatever is ultimately selfish, because if you're in it just so that you can get a gold medal or just so that you can build your bank account, ultimately you're doing it for the self, aren't you? If what you're doing is ultimately motivated by a selfish purpose, that's the biggest empty there is. Because what are we? Eventually, we all recognize that we're dust. And if all we ever do is for the self, that means everything we ever do goes back to dust. Accomplishes, in the end, absolutely nothing. That's a huge empty. How do you get over that? How do you get past that? We have to find something that's bigger than self in order to find true meaning, don't we? We have to find something more than self if we're to find meaning and value and purpose. Our life has to have meaning. And that meaning has to be more than just gratifying our passing desires and selfish desires. Our life has to have meaning, and it has to have value, and it has to be valued or appreciated in order for us to find a sense of satisfaction, to be in touch with a real meaning that has something that lasts. Ultimately, That value and that meaning comes from God. Ecclesiastes again in chapter 3. Ecclesiastes 3 and verse 11 tells us this. Ecclesiastes 3 verse 11. He, God, has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, He has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. That's a strange passage, I think. What is that really saying? God has put eternity in our hearts. At least that's the way it's rendered in the New King James. There are different translations that kind of word it differently. But what is this passage saying? That God has put eternity in our hearts, and nobody can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. The sense of this passage seems to be that there is a sense of something that God has given man that is greater than himself. There's an awareness of eternity, if you will, of something outside of or beyond self. But man can't find it out. Search as he might from beginning to end, man can't figure it out. And so there's always this emptiness, this hole. Solomon tried to figure it out. Man is incredible. We have this constant quest that drives mankind. We are always searching for and striving for something. Mankind just do that. Whether it's the space race, we have to figure out what's on the moon or Mars, or we are searching for something. We're striving to know more. We're striving to be more. Every time there's a world record set at the Olympics, every other swimmer or diver or volleyball player or whatever is out to try and set the new record to accomplish more than what was previously done. Man is on a constant quest for something more. Something. And it drives man to achieve. It drives him to become more than he is. It drives him to do his best. It drives him to explore. It drives him to search. It drives him to succeed. Because we're never satisfied ultimately with what we have. Because we have internally, there's something in us that knows we can do more. When God says He has placed eternity in our hearts, it's almost like there is this thing God has put in there that keeps us searching for what we don't know, don't have, and it keeps us always working, always moving ahead. This verse, Ecclesiastes 3, verse 11, is translated differently in a few other passages, or a few other translations, actually more paraphrases. But the contemporary English version puts it this way. God makes everything happen at the right time, yet none of us can ever fully understand all He has done. And He puts questions in our minds about the past and the future. Man is constantly questioning, isn't he? Questioning why, questioning what. We're always questioning. God's placed that in us. God's Word translation says this: it is beautiful how God has done everything at the right time. He has put a sense of eternity in people's minds. A sense of eternity in people's minds. And yet mortals still can't grasp what God is doing from beginning to the end of time. Isn't that true? Christ said, no man can come to me except the Father draws him. The carnal mind is enmity against God, isn't subject to the law of God, neither indeed can be. We don't have the mind of God. We aren't able to grasp the things of God unless God specifically calls us, opens our mind, gives us that appreciation, that blessing. But people are always trying to search for it and striving to find it out. But unless God specifically opens their mind to it, they will always be searching because man can't grasp it. Ultimately, all the searching for meaning in life, unless God reveals it and invites you to become a part of it, Man's meaning will be sought in wealth. Man's meaning will be sought in esteem. Man's meaning will be sought in every pleasure. And man will always say, that's not it. He'll always be led to the conclusion that Solomon came to, that it's vanity. It's not enough. That's not it. Ecclesiastes 8. Ecclesiastes 8, verse 16. When I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done on the earth, even though one sees no sleep day or night, you can work and work and work day and night, then I saw all the work of God that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. Solomon did see that there's a work of God and man can't figure it out. For though a man labors to discover it, yet he will not find it. Moreover, though a wise man attempts to know it, he will not be able to find it. What an incredible blessing to have the calling of God and the invitation to be a part of His family and His work, and to be given real meaning in life, to understand our purpose for life. I don't know if you remember the old ad that the church once had. It showed a picture of the earth in the big expanse, blackness of space. And it said, you are here. Question, why? What's the purpose? What a powerful ad that was. I always thought it was one of the best ads we ever had. What is our purpose? What's our meaning? Man is always searching for it. Now, you know, because man can't find it apart from God's help, we busy ourselves and distract ourselves so that we don't ask the question. And we will find every which way to fill our mind with something other than having to answer the question about the meaning of life. Man's good at distracting himself from that truth, from that reality. And I think that's especially true today when we have so many forms of entertainment and stuff to try and get our attention. Remember when there were only three major networks on television? Now you go, you have cable, and you've got hundreds and hundreds of channels to just fill yourself with. I mean, you can't even go, if you start at 7 o'clock and say, what do I want to watch today? And you start clicking through, and you find, oh, there's a program that started at 7 o'clock. By now it's 7:45, and the program's over because it took you that long to go through the hundreds of channels to find it. I mean, it's ridiculous how much is out there for us to just be distracted by. The ads that want to get your attention or that promise some satisfaction and joy that are abundant everywhere. It's just incredible. There's so much stuff to get our attention. But ultimately, if we just stop distracting ourselves by all of these things and we sit and consider life, we come to the same conclusion that Solomon came to. That apart from God, it's all vanity and emptiness. Now, the good thing about this drive that God has put in us, this sense of eternity that God has put in us, is that it does make us, it does drive us, it creates in us a desire to succeed and to improve, and we all benefit from that. I mean, we're always looking to do something better and to make our mark, and by people making their mark, they end up doing things that improve lives for people. And so there's a very, very good thing that comes from this sense of eternity that is in all of us because of that drive that it provides for us. But the downside of it is that unless God grants that relationship with Him and that harmony that we can have with Him and with His purpose, though a wise man attempts to know it, he will not be able to find it, and he will always end up coming up short and empty and realizing that there's something missing. Without a sense of purpose or value, our life can become dark and empty and worthless, can it? Despite how much people accomplish. That's what Herbert Armstrong found out in his interviews with the great and the wealthy and the famous of his day, the Clark Gables of his day, the bankers of his day. But their lives ended up empty. They were phenomenally successful in terms of their bank accounts, and they were on their fifth or sixth marriage. Terrible failures at just life. And wondering at the end, what's the purpose? What's it all about? And without being in tune with that sense of purpose or value, our lives become dark and empty and worthless. You know, there is a problem associated with loneliness. And it affects a lot of people, and it affects us in the church as well, you know, especially as folks who have given their lives to raising families and providing and doing things like that. Sometimes they get older, and mates die, and they end up alone, and their physical ability to do things becomes limited, and they end up facing loneliness. And what comes along with that is a sense of a loss of meaning. Because all through our lives, our meaning has been raising our families, doing things for our kids, seeing our grandkids grow up, and being able to be a part of an active church, and all of these things. And there's meaning because we can see ourselves doing something, and there's profit in it, and we get some value from that. And then you end up lonely, and life seems meaningless. And that's a real distressing condition. And it's a very real condition. We have to understand that. And those that are facing loneliness, you know, we should be aware of and reach out to and help them to see the meaning in their lives. Sometimes it's a matter of just being able to communicate, share experiences and lessons, and still contribute in some way, having meaning and purpose. Now, ultimately, as Christians, even when we're lonely, we're still involved in the Christian work of God's work. Character building and preparing to be a king and a priest in his kingdom. And that should guide and fulfill us no matter what, ultimately. But there are these other things also that are nice to have that provide additional senses of value and purpose and meaning in our lives. But finding meaning in something, almost anything. And if you don't have a relationship with God and the meaning that comes from that, people will seek to find meaning from almost anything. And it can drive them down dangerous and bad paths. I mean, think about why do people get involved with gangs and why don't they just get out of the gangs? What does that? But you know what? They find that they can have meaning to the gang by their contribution and they get value from that in some way. So what is it? It's this sense of I've found a place where I have meaning. And it can drive them down awful paths. Because this craving for meaning, purpose in life is huge. Now I recognize, of course, there are other factors involved. Just being able to say, hey, I got to have some money. I got to be able to buy food. And the life of crime is a way to do it. But you know what? That becomes much more secondary to the sense that they become welded with their buddies in crime because of the meaning that they have within that group. Unhealthy addictions can drive people's lives because of this need for meaning. Cults, not always religious cults, what do they play on? The sense of meaning that they can give to somebody. These are dangerous courses of life, but they're destructive. But what undergirds it is this need to find an idea of some value, purpose, meaning. Now, the search for meaning can be neutral, too. It doesn't have to just be in destructive paths. We can find a sense of meaning in recreational activities that are satisfying as long as it's secondary to our relationship with God and our real identity with God. But people can join clubs, photography clubs or bicycling clubs or hiking clubs, you know, and they can contribute to the club and other people's enjoyments. If they're in a hiking club, they can coordinate activities and participate with people, and there's a group and they have value being a part of it, and they can contribute, and it provides a certain level of meaning for them and joy and satisfaction that comes from that. Those are all wonderful, but they're neutral. And if that's the only identity that we have, ultimately, it's also passing, and we end up like Solomon saying, this too is vanity. And really, ultimately, what's the good of it? So those are good things to have. They're part of a healthy life, frankly, to have sense of meaning that we get from contributing at church or family and all of these things. But still, without God, it still falls short. People join clubs and get involved in hobby groups and things where they have that sense of value and identity, where they can receive a sense of value or appreciation, affirmation. That's okay. The point from that, though, is that we find meaning in context of value to others. Think about it. The things that we really truly find meaning in come in context with others because of what we can do with and for them. The value that we can provide to them gives us meaning. If our meaning or purpose is only and ultimately self, that's still empty. If you only join a club, let's say a hiking club, for self, so that you can get out and enjoy a hike, you know, that's still empty. Our joy, our satisfaction comes from sharing things and contributing to the benefit, to the welfare, and to the joy of others. When our whole life is motivated by doing something strictly for self, you know what? It's like a feedback loop. Our sound folks have to deal with feedback loops. And you know what? What goes out ends up circling back, and it just becomes this squeal. It's yikes. You can't bear that. Somebody who lives entirely for self only gives out so that he can consume back, and it's like this feedback loop, and his life implodes. It's like a feedback loop. It's terrible. So we have to have some value or benefit that we contribute to others for us to really have a sense of accomplishment or purpose. And that comes in context to what we do in value toward others. Traditionally, men, now more and more women as well, find meaning in work. They can give a hard day's work and they can get paid for it, and they can measure the meaning that it gives to somebody else by the size of their paycheck. Ultimately, their bank account. Maybe by the promotions that they get. And you know, you can become addicted to the feedback that you get, but if the only reason that you're doing it is so that you can build your paycheck and you're not working in order to be able to contribute to the good of the company and to the work that the company is doing, there's an emptiness there. People look for meaningful work. What does that mean? It means that they know that what they do is more than just for themselves, but it's doing some good. Right? That's what meaningful work is. Now, traditionally, as I said, men find meaning in work, and their value can be attached to a paycheck or to a position or whatever. But the problem with that is, again, context. Are they only doing it so they can be the CEO? If that's the only reason, their life is still going to be empty. They have to have some other context there in relation to other people and what they're doing with and for them. Traditionally married women find their meaning not from their work experiences. What do they find it from? Their family. They find their meaning from their association with their husband's work and accomplishments and so on. And they give and they work, again, in the context of a traditional family, in that sense. And that's in service to others, isn't it? It can be very satisfying. But when there's no recognition of it, it can be very devastating as well. So it needs to go, you need to be able to sense a value of appreciation there as well. In service to or in contribution to the welfare of others, the well-being of others, that's where a genuine sense of meaning comes in. Meaning gives an individual a sense of identity and value. We can and should find value in what we do, in the things that occupy our time, and the things that occupy our life. In order to be a healthy person, both spiritually as well as emotionally, we need to lend value to others. If we're not, our life will be hollow and it will be empty. We need to be valuable and we need to be valued. that is appreciated, loved, accepted by others. But ultimately, even just what comes from others is passing. And God provides meaning for our life that is not passing. God provides meaning for our life that is eternal. And let's recognize this important truth about God's plan. Understand this. This is something that we understand in God's church, that virtually no other religion understands, that virtually no other Christian understands. Think about it. Think about the hope that most people who profess to be Christians have. What is their hope? To go to heaven. Why? Why? So they can play a harp on a cloud forever. In the Catholic tradition, so that they can stare at the face of God, the beatific vision, forever. So that they don't have pain. Forever. In the Islamic world, so that they can have their 72 virgins to enjoy forever, whatever it is. But all religions have this hope, this goal of going to heaven or whatever their nirvana is, so that we can have something. Ultimately, what is that? Isn't that ultimately saying, I want to be there so I can get something? Isn't that ultimately a kind of a selfish motivation? Now, again, I'm not saying that we shouldn't desire to have peace, joy, satisfaction, and all of those things. You know, but that's going to come. God will provide that. But think about what God's plan is for us. God wants us in His family. Why? So that we can be part of His work of service to mankind as kings and priests and pillars and teachers of His way to grow His family forever. We have a purpose, something that we are doing, and it's not just for self. It involves the whole family of man, or the whole family of God. God provides meaning in our calling. Meaning beyond just, I want to learn to be the best harp player in this cloud as you can be. Do you see that difference? Do you see the difference in hope and in vision that we have because we understand God's plan that virtually no one else who claims to be a Christian grasps? This is unique, brethren. This is unique. God has a purpose for you to be a pillar, to be a king, to be a priest, to serve in the work of increasing His family. You have a purpose beyond yourself. You have a genuine value to others. Think of the value that you will be to others in the millennial reign of Jesus Christ who are learning the ways of God, that can look to you to be taught the ways that work, that produce good results, right results, that lead ultimately to eternal life in the family of God for them. Is that meaningful work? Does that give your life purpose and meaning more than being able to hang a gold medal on your shelf? And say, look what I did? When you can say, look at the family that I helped to create with God. Your life has meaning. It has importance. It has significance to others. And not just temporarily to others, like going down and feeding the homeless, which is fine. I'm not denying that's a good thing. You get a lot of satisfaction saying, I did something actually good for somebody. That's good. But you know, that person will still be hungry tomorrow. But when you are able, as a king and a priest, to serve others and to teach them God's way of life and to see them become a part of God's eternal family, that's forever. The increase of God's family, He said, there is no end. We'll have that work forever. The search for meaning drives all of us. Every human being has it. It's inside us. We search for meaningful work in this life, and we find meaning in our families because we contribute to them. I mean, there's, what greater joys, pleasure are there, humanly speaking, than to raise a family, to take care of children, to raise them up, and so on. It's just, it's fantastic, isn't it? We give our lives as parents and as grandparents to contribute, to serve. So we find meaning in our family. We find meaning in service, whether it's to the church or to our community. These are all right and good things. Some people search for meaning only in the sense of getting esteem from men. Or some people search for meaning in getting a bigger bank account, and that's what they perceive as giving meaning to their lives. Meaning, purpose of my life is to make a fortune. Well, they give their lives to the purpose of getting, whether it's getting appreciation or getting or winning a sense of meaning from others. Because the bigger your bank account, the more you get appreciation or admiration from others. The bigger your position, the more admiration you get from others. That's a get motive. Not a give motive. It's a get motive. It's like for people like that, it's like life has no meaning for them unless they can hear someone tell them how they have meaning. And their life enters a feedback loop. And like Michael Phelps, their life crashes. Ultimately, when they realize that they're in an endless loop that goes nowhere. With God's calling, though, we understand that we have the esteem, the honor, of the greatest being of the universe, God Himself, who loves us, and loves us so much, He has assured us of His love. He sent His Son to die for us and to make the way possible for us, to show us the way to eternal life in His family. So we see that love of God for us expressed through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. We see through the many, many ways that God works in our lives, answers our prayers, intervenes for us in different ways. We see His love demonstrated for us repeatedly. And now we see that, and we know that He will exalt and honor us. He will give us esteem. Those who humble themselves will be honored by God. We can rest assured in that. We don't have to go out and seek esteem from others and demand esteem from others by our browbeating them with our accomplishments or our bank account or our position or whatever. We don't have to seek that from others to get satisfaction and some sort of meaning associated with our lives. God will give it to us. He will give it to us. Let another man praise you and not your own lips. Right? These are the principles of God's word. Humble yourself and God will exalt you. So we don't have to worry about that. God will grant us that honor. As long as we are a part of His work of service. We're assured of that. He will gladly give us all those strokes, all those benefits, all that recognition. It will come our way. But He also knows that in order for us to be whole, in order for us to truly know peace and not that empty gnawingness, our life must be meaningful. Our life must be involved in contribution and service. Others must find benefit from our life in some way. So He invites us to participate in His work, in His most meaningful work that exists in the universe, drawing people into His family, showing them the right way to live, and granting them eternal life. It's the most meaningful work and service that there can be. With God's calling, our life has meaning, and the search for meaning is over. The whole rest of the world can still be searching for meaning in all kinds of different roads and directions and paths. Our search for meaning is over when we understand the purpose that God has given us, the calling that He's given us. And now what we enjoy is the great blessing of living a life with meaning. Let's live our life with meaning.